charge that you just be quiet.
Well,
you
why?
Be quiet.
You don't own me.
I don't
own
salary.
You.
Fireworks at a hearing on Anwar. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 18th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, South Central's cold weather takes a toll on the homeless and those who work to help them.
You wonder, where's the end? I mean, you know, I would hope I would not be in a growth industry.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Expectations are fading fast that the congressional committee tasked with coming up with a budget deal will succeed. Alaska's delegation has been watching from the sidelines like most other members of the House and Senate. Senator Lisa Murkowski has voiced frustration at not having the process open to all of Congress. Now the Republican is part of a group of 150 members urging the committee in its final days to go big and go bold.
We are running out of time extraordinarily fast. The committee really has until just Monday to report something out in order to meet the deadline of the 23rd.
Murkowski says she's heard rumblings that both sides are holding out for their partisan agendas, but she warns that won't accomplish anything. In recent days, leaders in Congress have thrown partisan jabs, blaming the other side for what may be a stalemate. But Democratic Senator Mark Begich hopes the committee can stay behind closed doors and ignore the partisan and lobbying pressure.
Always optimistic to the end, and you know, I'm hopeful that they come up with something that's significant enough and balanced that it has revenues and cuts and a balanced investment portfolio around energy, education, and infrastructure.
Begich says if nothing advances over this weekend, he'll be, in his words, less optimistic. If the super committee doesn't come up with a plan by Wednesday to save at least $1.2 trillion over a decade, automatic spending cuts will kick in starting in 2013. As Congress struggles to find ways to bring down the national debt, Republicans in the House are offering a plan to increase oil and gas production. Part of that includes opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to development. A House committee held two hearings today in Washington on drilling in Alaska. As Libby Casey reports, it was a familiar litany of arguments, but also had some fireworks.
Colorado Republican Congressman Doug Lamborn opened up Friday morning's hearing on GOP oil and gas bills by saying they are a way to get people working.
Americans are desperate for new jobs, and blue-collar workers in our trades have been particularly hard hit by the economic downturn. Critics will say these bills are a giveaway to the oil industry. Nothing could be further from the truth. These bills are designed to open lands to create opportunity.
A quartet of Republican bills includes one to open the Arctic Refuge, or ANWR, to drilling. Money they generate would go toward the Highway Trust Fund to pay for America's infrastructure projects. But Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey, a well-known opponent of Arctic drilling, says Republicans are overselling their plan.
The four bills we are considering today would only generate 1/15th of the revenue that we would need to fund transportation projects for the next 6 years. These bills would leave us $70 billion short of funding our transportation projects over that time.
Markey says instead support a plan by Democrats to ratchet back the subsidies oil and gas companies get. He says it would save $19 billion in 10 years. The renewed push to drill in ANWR comes as Congress battles desperately over ways to save money or gain new revenues. But even though the atmosphere may be new, the arguments are familiar. At Friday afternoon's hearing, Congressman Don Young voiced the feelings of many.
I will tell you, if you ever want to see an exercise in futility, it's this hearing. That side's already made up his mind. This side has already made up its mind.
Congressman Young has been fighting to open Anwar for decades and doesn't have patience for people who disagree with him. From his seat on the House Natural Resources Committee dais, he often yells at witnesses with differing opinions, especially environmentalists. But on Friday afternoon, when he tried to chastise one witness, the witness fought back. Young criticized the position of Douglas Brinkley, a well-known historian and professor at Rice University in Texas. Brinkley is against drilling in the Arctic Refuge and recently wrote a book about the wilderness battles in Alaska. When Young started to bash the position of drilling opponents, Brinkley cut him off.
And the, I call it garbage, Dr. Rice. It comes from a mouth.
Dr. Brinkley, Rice is a university.
Well, okay, I know you went to Rice College. I'll call you anything I want to call you, sat in that chair. You understand? You just be quiet.
Well, but
you
why?
Be quiet.
You don't own me.
I don't
pay your
own
salary.
You. I can tell you right now.
The gentleman will suspend, and I'll remind members, and I'll remind
witnesses.
I work
for the private sector. You work for the
Mr.
Taxpayers.
Brinkley.
Brinkley knocked the congressman's education while Young ordered him to be quiet. Brinkley says he's been camping in the Arctic Refuge, but Young mocked him for that and accused him of being elitist.
Now, I have been all over that area.
I know you have.
And I know what I'm talking about. The Arctic Plain is really nothing. You say it's not the heart. It is not the heart. It is not the heart. It is part of the most deficit part of the area. And what hurts me the most is you sit there in the Rice University. When the people support drilling for their good and for the good of this nation, as a college professor in an ivory tower, you can go up there and camp and spend your time, and I hope you spend a lot of money. But the reality is this area should be drilled. I've been fighting this battle for 39 years.
The fighting on Friday, though, was in the House hearing room. Douglas Brinkley criticized Young for not sitting through the whole hearing and showing up late. Young was furious, saying he'd missed the start because he had to vote on the floor. Young often comes and goes at hearings, and he left before Friday afternoon's was over. Brinkley took aim again at his absence and disagreed with Young's claim that the late former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens helped create Anwar for development.
There was a misstatement made by the congressman who's yet again left, doesn't stay, blows smoke, and then leaves. But Ted Stevens had been for the creation of Anwar in 1960. Ted Stevens was a lawyer for the creation of the Arctic. It's only when oil was found there that they wanted to break.
The rest of Friday's testimony was less dramatic, but very familiar. Gwich'in Athabascan activist Sarah James of Arctic Village testified in favor of protecting the refuge, as did environmentalists from national organizations. At the earlier first hearing, pro-drilling witnesses included Tara Sweeney, a senior vice president at the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and Mark Helmerichs of Colville Village, who wants more oil industry jobs. Familiar arguments Alaskan faces, and new heat over an old question, what to do about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The Fairbanks Borough Assembly has voted to allocate up to $25,000 to support a lawsuit challenging the proposed Alaska redistricting plan. The litigants are two local men who are suing to get the redistricting plan overturned. The borough officially dropped out of the case last month, but the subsequent election of two new assembly members resulted in the idea of financially supporting the case. The motion to spend the money passed 5-4. The case is set for trial in January. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an effort to give tribes more authority to tackle crime in rural Alaska.
For too long, we've seen bootleggers and domestic violence and sexual abuse offenders walking our village streets unabated.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
In Washington, lawmakers are taking a look at legislation that could alter the way law enforcement and justice are carried out in rural Alaska. Earlier this month, Alaska Senator Mark Begich and other state leaders testified before the Senate Indian Affairs Committee at a hearing about the Alaska Safe Villages and Villages Act of 2011. KDLG's Daisha Eaton has more.
The act aims to give rural Alaska communities more tools to combat their high rates of substance abuse, domestic violence, child abuse, and suicide. Last week, Senator Begich testified before the committee about the proposed legislation, which would put more power and responsibility in the hands of local people.
Dealing with the realities of crime in rural Alaska Native villages requires comprehensive and innovative solutions, which include the ability to access the resources and tools they need to promote the well-being of these communities.
The act would provide funding for up to 9 Alaska Native tribes to participate in demonstration projects, allowing tribes to establish tribal ordinances, create and strengthen tribal courts, and impose their own sanctions on violators. Senator Lisa Murkowski also spoke before the committee. She said Alaska's geography presents serious challenges to dealing with law enforcement, and lawmakers need to think outside the box, particularly when dealing with the alcohol and violence-related crimes that have become commonplace in bush villages.
We cannot leave our villages behind. We cannot leave our communities in fear. We cannot leave our families carrying the burden of the stories of devastation and ruin that have come to them because of incidents that have been unchecked that we could have resolved.
The legislation is broadly supported by the Alaska Native community and the Alaska Federation of Natives. AFN passed a resolution in support of the bill during their 2011 convention. Ralph Anderson, Bristol Bay Native Association president and co-chair of the board of directors of AFN, also testified at the hearing. He explained to lawmakers that S-1192 would help clarify the extent of tribal authority in Alaska, which, because Alaska tribes do not have land-based jurisdiction, has been unclear up to now.
We're not advocating for the creation of Indian country in Alaska. I want to make that very clear. We are advocating and think it makes enormous sense to allow tribes to handle some explicit and specific types of problems in their villages and to clearly define what those types of cases are.
Cases about alcohol and abuse are the ones Anderson thinks should be dealt with more efficiently through tribal ordinances and courts, Anderson explains.
For too long, law enforcement in rural Alaska has been underfunded and in many small remote villages virtually non-existent. The Alaska state court system does not reach out far enough or fast enough for many of our remote, isolated villages.
Joe Masters, the commissioner for the Alaska Department of Public Safety, also testified before the committee. He expressed concern that the legislation contains ambiguous provisions that could be counterproductive.
Dividing the state into jurisdictional project areas subject to separate rules, separate court systems, or separate court systems is not a practical approach for the long term. Rather, programs addressing law enforcement training, programs for technical and programmatic support to village and tribal councils, and programs directed to regional and community efforts are all areas where the federal government can truly be part of the solution.
The state of Alaska does not support the bill, citing concerns it could usurp state authority. Senator Begich introduced the legislation back in June. The next step for the bill is a markup in the Indian Affairs Committee and an official review of the legislative language. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The biting north winds that buffeted Anchorage earlier this week may have relented, but the pressure on the city's overnight shelters has not. That's true even for Beans Cafe, primarily known for serving meals, but now functioning as an overflow shelter. KSKA's Len Anderson has the story.
We've had the over 100 crowd for the last 3 nights, and you know, the numbers have been increasing significantly.
Jim Crockett is executive director of Beans Cafe, which for over 3 decades has served free hot breakfasts and lunches to the city's poor. But Beans is adjacent to the Brother Francis shelter, and when cold weather causes the shelter to hit capacity, the cafe clears its dining area floor and welcomes the overflow. Crockett says last year, the first time Beans had overnight sleepers was in November. This year, it was toward the end of October. What's more, he adds, there was quite a difference in numbers.
Last year, the first week in November, we slept over seven people. So we slept over 72 people our first day here in 2011.
The numbers increased as November progressed and the low temperatures combined with heavy winds arrived. One likely factor is Mayor Dan Sullivan's policy of dismantling the illegal campsites, where in previous years some individuals might have hunkered through all but the coldest days. And Crockett sees another factor.
Their crowd is getting older and more frail and more fragile. Their bones are getting a little weaker, so they have to come in and get them a little warm. So we're seeing a lot more people than we had in prior years.
In his 10 years with Beans Cafe, this is the earliest, heaviest overnight pressure Crockett has seen at the facility.
So far, our overflow this year has exceeded over 1,000 people. That's 1,000 in addition to what Brother Francis sleeps of 240 a night. These numbers are significant and climbing, and we need to be aware of them, and we need to set up what I'll call contingency plans in relationship to our capacity, meaning at Beans.
Crockett says when Beans reaches legal capacity, there's no other backup capable of handling any sizable numbers of street people. Housing so many people has strained Beans Cafe resources. For example, the gas bill has risen because of increased heating needs, as well as the water bill, also based on usage. And there's the strain on the food service. Beans not only provides hot meals to those who seek overnight shelter, but the ever-increasing numbers who come just for food.
We see the working poor, people that are making small amounts of money as far as hourly pay, and look in the refrigerators toward the middle of the month, and there's nothing there after they paid their electricity and their rent bills.
Beans Cafe is currently serving over 450 people at a single meal in a facility with a seating capacity of 263. If the meal numbers have risen by 20% over last year, Crockett says donations have not. Rather, they're down. And looming ahead is the annual Thanksgiving meal, which Crockett expects to expand from 1,500 to 2,000 diners. And those contributions have been slow as well. Beans is looking to the community. Besides Thanksgiving hams, turkeys, and fixings, Beans needs monetary contributions for the increasing staff and utility expenses. They can be made via the website beanscafe.org. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Some 20 homes are still without power on the Kenai Peninsula after a severe windstorm struck the area on Wednesday. Homer Electric Association spokesman Joe Gallagher says most of the affected homes are in Nikiski.
We're right down to the final neighborhood that does not have power. That's a place called Mark Boulevard out in Nikiski, where we've got a few homes that still do not have power. A crew is there right now. They're working to restore power to the Mark Boulevard area, and we expect that by early this evening, the folks at Mark Boulevard should have their power restored, and that will basically take care of the outage restoration. There are still a few scattered single-home outages where transformers have been damaged and will need to replace those. But for the most part, we should have this wrapped up by Friday evening.
Gallagher says early estimates put the cost of damage at about $1 million. He says this week's storm came on the heels of a previous windstorm earlier in the month. He says such strong winds are not common on the peninsula, and two storms in a row with severe winds are rare.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates four decades of dependable financing and competitive interest rates for Alaskans. Find out more by asking your lender or real estate professional how Alaska Housing can assist you with buying a home. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Support for AK comes from the Federal Aviation Administration, providing information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Charlotte Duran. This week on AK, school lunch. One of the challenges of living in remote Alaska is easy access to fresh food like produce. But that's not the case at a school in Tenakee Springs, where every day the students get a meal that goes above and beyond the usual cafeteria fare. KCAW's Ed Ronco had lunch with 10 students at Tenakee School and has this story.
All right, grown-ups, remember school lunch? You know, the mashed potatoes served with an ice cream scoop, the hairnets, the stuff that wanted to be pizza when it grew up. Well, the students who are growing up now in Tenakee Springs will have very different memories of the middle of the school day. They'll remember meat and potato croquettes, or chicken a la king, or any of the myriad of foods that are part of the Tenakee Springs school lunch program.
I don't think what we're cooking is any different than what you guys do in Sitka or whatever. I think what makes it unusual, like I say, is the availability of fresh produce.
That's Wendy Stern, who shares cooking duties a week on, a week off, with Susan Lee, a trained chef who travels to Juneau every other week and comes back with a lot of produce. Some of it is on the cutting board that sits right in front of Stern.
So we've got some mushrooms for the salad here.
Yeah, mushrooms, tomatoes, mushrooms. There will be some out there that will pick these mushrooms right out of their salad. Others that used to pick mushrooms out of their salad and now eat them. So you see headway's being made. Try to chop them up small so that I hide them.
While some of the produce comes from Juneau, a lot of the vegetables come from local farmer Dale Zeal. The community has a fairly active local food scene, and besides her duties at the school, Stern helps organize a farmer's market here in the summer. She says people in Tenakee take their produce seriously.
It's only in Tenakee that I've heard of, you know, broccoli wars.
Broccoli wars?
Oh, absolutely.
As in?
People won't speak to each other if someone takes too much broccoli and it's the beginning of broccoli season. Or someone wipes out the peas. And you're the next in line and all the peas are gone. We're talking major bad feelings about stuff like
that. For real?
For real. Oh, it's the real deal. Yeah.
There are no wars allowed in the line at Tenakee School, where the students are given carefully measured portions of food in accordance with USDA guidelines. Parent Shauna Harper says that's part of the reason the program exists.
We decided to do it because we wanted to ensure that our kids were getting healthy food during the day.
Harper helped start the school lunch program about 3 years ago. Produce isn't the only thing that comes from local sources. So does protein. It's not unusual for the school to get a hold of a fish someone's caught or some local venison. Harper says processing those things correctly takes a little extra work.
But it also means that we're not feeding our kids, you know, beef that we don't know where it came from and chicken that could be questionable. I mean, they're eating a lot of fresh fish and venison as well.
Harper says it's important to teach the building blocks of a healthy diet, but that the lunch program also fosters a sense of community.
There's a lot of camaraderie with it because they all sit down in a family-style setting and they joke and they laugh and they really enjoy lunch together as one big group.
Lunch is served under the atrium at the center of the school. It's taco pie with a fresh green salad today. Seventh grader Quinn Keel says he likes the lunches here.
It's less like fast food and more like food, I guess.
He says the menu changes a lot, which is nice, and that students can put in special requests on birthdays.
Or if everyone begs hard enough, long enough, we'll eventually get it.
Keel says he's easy to please, so it's hard to pick a favorite.
Yeah, I pretty much eat everything, so... Yeah. Some people, they don't like stir fry, but...
Yeah. But you're cool with most of it.
Yeah. Like some of it I like more than other things, but I basically eat everything, so yeah.
With 10 palates to please, you'd think organizing the menus would be difficult.
You know, I love it.
That's Susan Lee, the trained chef who oversees the program. She also teaches cooking to the students and introduces them to world cuisines. Lee says the students fill out surveys at the beginning of the year about the things they like and the things they don't like.
And then I just warn them, well, everybody likes something different and doesn't like something different, so we're going to have at least one thing throughout the year that you won't like.
She says most of them try everything and eat everything, and that they have pretty sophisticated palates.
The biggest thing is for kids to enjoy food and enjoy cooking and be interested in it, know where it came from, know the history of it.
And that, says Lee, teaches them to be smart eaters now and hopefully for the rest of their lives. For AK, I'm Ed Ronco in Tenakee Springs.
And now it's time for our 300 Villages segment. Today we're heading to the small village of Nightmute on the Bering Sea coast.
My name is Janet Lawrence. I live in Nightmute, and I work at City of Nightmute, and I'm a clerk. It's a small village. It's about 280 people, residents of Nightmute. Nichta, that's our Yupik name. Muslim at home, yeah, we speak in Yupik. But nowadays, our young, like our kids, mostly speak in Kasak nowadays, but some of them, they understand, yeah. But on my side, age, we mostly speak in Yupik. Here in the night, we stay to Eskimo dance on weekends, like Friday and Sundays. And bingo days is on Monday, actually Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Then they do jigging for lust fish. And tomcods, pike. We cook them. Sometimes we freeze them, hang them, dry them, and eat them. Yummy foods, healthy foods. I love it because it's quiet, hardly drunk people, hardly violent. It's a quiet village, especially in summertime when half of the village go down to fish camp. Nightmute is very quiet.
That was Janet Lawrence in Nightmute. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ed Ronco and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for a unique take on Thanksgiving. A lot of people in Alaska are far from home for the holiday, but the mayor of Unalaska has come up with a fun way to make sure everyone can share a turkey dinner with a family. I'm Charlotte Duren.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, and Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. Charlotte Duren was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.